Thank you, Vera, for the nice introduction. And I'd like to start my talk by giving credit to Dr. Perez Velasquez, who is actually the driving force of this of the organization of this very interesting symposium. So it's a great pleasure for me to be here and to have this opportunity to present some of the research that we are doing in our lab, in particular about brain rhythms and what they tell us about the functional connectivity of the brain. But actually, before I start talking about that topic, I would like to give you an introduction of the research that we do in my lab. So this is my team, present and past members. In my lab, we do a combination of experimental and theoretical studies. Approximately one-third of our work is experimental, is in vitro electrophysiology, and two-thirds is computational and mathematical work, and we try to combine those tools to investigate similar problems, most of them in neuroscience and mathematical biology. So there are like three big projects going on in the lab right now. Pavel Pusserey is the experimentalist in our lab. He's doing in vitro electrophysiology, and we are investigating how cortical networks in vitro are how excitation and inhibition are balanced in those networks. And as you can imagine, that's important to understand the origin of epileptic seizures, among other diseases. And in particular, we are investigating how neuromodulators like serotonin and acetylcholine affect that balance between excitation and inhibition. So my other graduate student is Nick Schmand, and Nick is doing computational work. We are investigating the biophysical mechanisms that underlie the variability of firing in neurons. Neurons are noisy devices, not only neurons, but also the synapses, and that randomness has an impact on how neurons can work and function. And in particular, we are investigating how certain ion channel mutations in the neuron's membrane introduce variability, increase the stochasticity of those mechanisms, and create spiking variability. That's relevant for cerebellar ataxia, where it's known that certain mutations in calcium channels render the neurons really stochastic in your cerebellum, and that creates some kind of discoordination of motion. And Yanan Zhu, he's a senior graduate student from biology. He's graduating this year, and he's going to do a master thesis in my lab. And we are investigating cardioventilatory coupling using the techniques that Professor Rosenblum just exposed before. And we are doing data analysis. We have a collaboration with clinicians as well as with physiologists who do experiments in vivo or in situ preparations with rats. And we analyze and investigate those data and try to make a model of it. Now, Carl Steinke, he graduated already. He did his master's thesis in my lab. He's a biomedical engineer, and now he's working for Boston Scientific Neuromodulation. And the main topic of his thesis is actually what I'm going to present today. Eliza Milner, she graduated already, and she's now at Harvard. She did some computational work on cortical networks. So now, let's go to the main topic of my talk, brain rhythms. Let's give a loose definition of what that means. By that, we mean oscillatory patterns of brain activity as recorded, for example, with EEG or MEG. Now, brain rhythms have been investigated thoroughly from many different perspectives for many decades, and some of the highlights of our understanding in those lines is what are the mechanisms, what are the biophysical mechanisms that generate oscillations of electrical activity in the brain. And in particular, a lot of attention has been invested in the mechanisms of neuronal synchronization that are thought to underlie those oscillations. It's known, many mechanisms are known today about how neurons synchronize with each other, and it's known that those mechanisms are not unique. They are different across different brain regions, in the olfactory bulb, in the cerebellum, in the thalamus, in the cortex. They also occur at different time scales. So in some cases, the synapses are crucial for that. In some cases, gap junctions, which are electrical synapses between neurons, are crucial for that. Some other cases, you have neurons that actually behave as pacemakers and create rhythms on their own. So, you know, all those mechanisms, that variety of mechanisms has been studied from many different perspectives. And to some extent, it's well known under which circumstances neurons will be synchronized and will tend to generate rhythms in a bigger brain. Brain rhythms have been also investigated from the cognitive perspective because it's known that certain oscillations of the EEG correlate with different states of attention and awareness. So that's an obvious way of investigating those. And there are several studies devoted to that as well. But in this project, I'm going to take a very different perspective. And I'm going to focus not on how brain rhythms emerge or what they might tell us about how the brain uses them for function. I'm going to use it, as an engineer, and I'm going to try to say, what are they telling us about the brain structure? So I'm going to take like engineer's approach. You have a black box. You record the dynamics of that black box, your brain rhythms, and from that you're going to try to figure out, you're going to try to reverse engineer what the black box is made of. Okay. So this is a sketch of scalp recordings from EEG data, but you can't pretend that it's any kind of recordings from brain activity. And if you do that from different sensors, from different channels, you're going to see these oscillations, these brain rhythms that I was talking about before. And what I'm plotting here is different features that those rhythms present. People have noticed, and that's been known for a while, but this is a common feature of many complex systems and stochastic systems as well, that there is a background. If you compute the power spectrum of the channels and then you average those power spectra, then you get like some kind of power law decay. And that's what we are going to be referring to as the background group. So we are going to try to reverse engineer virtual brains. That's how we call our black boxes that we are going to try to investigate. And we are going to see what kind of black box, what kind of dynamical system or virtual brain generates a spectrum like this. Now, in normal brains, if you take recordings for a very long period of time, and in which the subject is not doing any specific task, but it's like the resting state or also doing many different kind of things, over long periods of time, you will see that the power spectrum on a logarithmic frequency scale, it has like different frequency bands. That's been known for a while. But what has intrigued people a lot recently is that those peaks, when plotted on a logarithmic scale, seem to be evenly spaced. The explanation for that, or the reason why people think that that's important, is because they are trying to, what that means is that their frequencies are irrational multiples of each other, so they cannot phase lock. And if they don't phase lock, it's probably because they are trying to separate information differently or to route information differently. That's actually one of the main themes of Georgi Bouzaki's book, titled Brain Rhythms or Rhythms of the Brain. And we have idealized that condition here, taking data from his book to plot like different frequency bands. And we are going to try to reconstruct brains that generate that power spectrum. Now, it's also known that in certain diseases, pathologies of the brain, the high frequencies are strongly attenuated in general. So we are going to try to reverse engineer brains that have that feature in which the high frequencies are lost. Those pathologies are related to autism, schizophrenia, diseases in which there is some obvious or some explicit cognitive impairment. So we want to reconstruct brains with that feature and see how they deviate from brains that have like a normal EEG. Now, Dr. Perez Velasquez and other colleagues have shown that in epileptic brains, you have phase locking between different frequency bands. So, and that seems to be a signature of these epileptic brains. So we also wanted to model brains in which the frequency bands are actually allowed to phase lock so that the bands are rational multiples of each other. And they actually showed it for the lower frequency bands, but we are going to take that, you know, as if it was the case for all the frequency bands. Now, it's true that people have observed phase locking between frequency bands also in normal subjects during specific cognitive tasks, but that phase locking seems to be quite transient, okay? Not like a sustained phenomenon. So we are going to investigate then these four cases. We are going to try to reconstruct brains where you don't have like brain rhythms, you just have like, you know, that 1 over F kind of background. We are going to investigate also black boxes or virtual brains that have like a normal kind of power spectrum, and also we are going to investigate these two other cases where those brain rhythms are altered. And the underlying assumption is that if we are able to reconstruct brains generating those kind of dynamics, then the actual brains should also share the same structural features that the virtual brains do. And from that, we are going to try to infer what kind of connectivity alterations are in disease. Now, what's the theoretical approach behind this reverse engineering approach? So we know that neural dynamics is highly nonlinear, and it can be investigated from many different perspectives, but the one that we would take here is closer to what is called neural mast models. So we are not modeling exactly single neurons, but rather groups of neurons that have this kind of nonlinear dynamics. This would be like basically the neuronal field, or you know, a proxy of the the field potential that you would record with electrodes. Then you have some kind of nonlinear intrinsic dynamics or whatever kind of dynamics, and then you have some network interactions plus noise. So this is basically the Wilson-Cohen model proposed in the 70s. And your network can be driven by deterministic or stochastic forces as well. Now, people who have investigated these models more accurately, for example, investigating like thalamocortical oscillations like Peter Robinson in Australia, one thing that they note is that if you ignore the input, this system by itself tends to settle into a fixed point. Obviously, if you investigate like different connectivity patterns, you can even have like some kind of chaotic behavior, like for example, where when the interactions between the neurons are random, then you can get chaotic behavior and a wide variety of qualitative behaviors. You can also get like sustained oscillations multi-periodic events as well. But the point is that if you take connectivity patterns that are very realistic, in the absence of stimulation, this tends to settle around a fixed point. And that's that fixed point is actually hyperbolic, so you can linearize around it. And if you linearize around it and include some stochastic forcing, then basically what you have is like a multivariate Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. So this would be basically like a description of the fluctuations that you would see in some sort of resting state. Now, the advantage of this approach is now that the functional connectivity is just a linear operator. It's a matrix. So our goal is to figure out what that matrix looks like so that you have a multivariate Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process that has the power spectrum that we specify, that we prescribe, which are the ones that I showed you before. So we have like, there is a forward problem so that if you know the connectivity matrix, then you can generate the fields. But actually we are going to be focusing on an inverse problem, that is that we know the power spectrum, the average power spectrum of this guy. So what can we say about the connectivity from that guy? So two questions. First, can we solve that problem? And if so, what are the connectivities like? So now is the point where we can use all the machinery known for multivariate Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. And one thing that we know is that in those models, the eigenvalues of the connectivity matrix, so the eigenvalues of W, determine the peaks of the power spectrum as well as the background. So in particular, for all the spectra that I showed you here, you can, from those, you can directly know where the eigenvalues, some of the eigenvalues that generate the peaks. So each peak is going to be determined by a complex conjugate pair of eigenvalues. So knowing the peaks is equivalent to knowing the location of eigenvalues there. So basically you can know the eigenvalues for each of these peaks and for each of these cases. I'm just plotting here this would be like the real part. This is the complex plane. These are the eigenvalues. And this is the real part of the eigenvalues. This is the imaginary component extracted directly from the spectrum. And obviously for each of those, you would have like the symmetric, which is the complex conjugate. And then to generate the background, so with these eigenvalues, these complex eigenvalues, you would only generate the peaks. But if in addition to that, you want to generate the background, you need, in order to get such a background, you need like a homogeneous distribution of eigenvalues along the real axis, which corresponds to dissipation over all possible time scales in your system. Now, one thing that I should mention here is that from the eigenvalues, we know that the power spectrum is just a superposition of Lorentzians. So, and that superposition of Lorentzians can also be rewritten as this in matrix form. But basically the point is that if you know the spectrum, you know a lot about the eigenvalues of the connectivity matrix. So our reverse engineering problem reduces to an inverse eigenvalue problem. I give you the eigenvalues of a matrix. Now you tell me what kind of matrices can have that spectrum of eigenvalues. Now, the solution is obviously not unique, but you can impose certain constraints. For example, we know that the connectivity of the brain is not, it's not full connectivity, right? So we are going to introduce some sparseness constraint. And basically what we say is that 30% of the connections, or at least 35% of the connections should be zero. So again, this is basically the line of thought. We know the power spectrum, hence we know the eigenvalues. From the eigenvalues, we are going to try to determine the connectivity matrix, imposing some constraint on the sparsity of that matrix. Now, even in that case, after imposing some kind of constraint, the solution might not be unique. But in applied math, people have figured out a way of reconstructing matrices with that problem, being aware of the fact that you're not going to have a unique solution. So we are taking the approach proposed by Moody, Chu, and Golub, which is to find a solution in a least square sense. Which that means is that we want to minimize the Frobenius norm of the difference between the connectivity matrix that we want to find out and a projection of the connectivity matrix, which is basically our connectivity matrix after setting many entries to zero, which is actually our constraint. And in addition to that, we are going to have the constraint that we know the connectivity matrix of that. So basically, we have to minimize this problem. This is a minimization problem that can be solved in the matrix space using the Frobenius norm by following the gradient, the steepest descent in that space. And that gradient involves Fréchet derivatives because, you know, we are in a matrix space, not a vector space. But, you know, the solution to that has been proposed by mathematicians. You have the reference below, and it basically reduces to integrating this differential equation of matrices in the matrix space. So if we integrate this over this parameter S, which is like a fake time, then V will converge to a matrix, and if we take this operation, then that would give us the matrix that we were looking for. So it's going to give us a matrix that satisfies the constraint on sparsity as well as on the eigenvalues. If we do that several times, starting with random matrices as initial conditions, then we can get like many different virtual brains, each of which is going to have, it's going to generate the signals with the brain rhythms that we prescribed. So let me give you some examples of that. This is the, once you reconstruct your W, your connectivity matrix, you can investigate the strengths, so the distribution of the strengths of that matrix. Those matrices are obviously not symmetric, so you have some kind of directionality in the connectivity between the nodes, but they are in general very well balanced. So that if you plot the distribution of the synaptic weights or you know, strength weights, that distribution is symmetric and it peaks sharply around zero. So in general, you tend to obtain fairly sparse matrices, much more sparse than the constraint that we imposed. Now, we can, once you know the matrix, you can simulate that Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process and basically solve the forward problem, so you can generate traces, generate the activity pattern, the EEG patterns that those networks would generate, and here we have some examples of that. And we can also compute the power spectrum of the dynamics of the reconstructed networks, and you see that there is, you know, a perfect match between what we imposed, and which is black here, and then the simulated activity of that network, which is these blue dots. Now, you can also rank the nodes of that connectivity matrix according to their total strength, to the total strength of the inputs and the output. So low rank in that case are highly connected nodes or the hubs of that network, and what we see is that the most important nodes in the network, the ones that have most of the strength, they have they display oscillatory patterns, and those oscillatory patterns are actually quite rich in the sense that they have like many different frequencies. But as you go to less important nodes that are weakly connected to the rest of the guys in the network, you would see like fairly flat signals. So visually, I think that has some kind of clinical implication, because if you are investigating EEG patterns, then those electrodes that display the richest structure, patterns that are, you know, show the more complex wiggles, those are going to be the interesting nodes in the network. Those are the signals that are being sampled from the hubs in the network. So if we do a spectrogram analysis, so how the frequency changes over time in the different in different nodes, so this would be for a node that is weakly connected, then this is less weakly connected, so more strongly connected to the rest of the network, and so on. And this guy is like the a strongly connected node. If we sample from the weak and the strong nodes, you see that the activity patterns get more complex in the sense that the hubs tend to contain more frequencies, and those frequencies. Here we have like four or at least two strong frequency bands, and here for the strongest one we have like at least five out of the eight peaks that we had there. So now we can also investigate what's the effect on the power spectrum of removing a given node. And if you remove, so here we have the power spectrum that we prescribed as a function of the node that we remove. So if we remove a very important node, then we mess up the spectrum. If we remove a weakly connected node, then most of the structure that we prescribed is actually preserved, the high frequency bands and the low frequency bands. So we can plot basically the correlation between the error, the mean quadratic error between the spectrum that we prescribed and the spectrum that we get after removing that node. And what we see is that the error is very large in general when we remove highly connected or strongly connected nodes, whereas if we remove weakly connected nodes, that error is actually very small. And we can do that for different groups, and we see that when we don't have brain rhythms, when we only have like a background spectrum, all the virtual brains that only have like a background spectrum, for those, removing one node or the other doesn't matter, whereas for all the other cases, the incomplete case, the entrained case, which is modeling epileptic brains, and also for the normal brain, in all those cases, removing hubs have like a main impact. And I will tell you why that's so important in a second. Basically, the general properties of the dynamics of virtual brains is that the signals that you see from strongly connected nodes display richer activity patterns, mixing various frequency components. I also showed you that removing strongly connected nodes has a bigger impact on the EEG power spectrum than removing the weakly connected nodes. One important feature of the networks that we reconstruct is that there are no nodes specialized in a single frequency. So you don't have like pacemakers at this level of description. The oscillations, the brain rhythms, do emerge from network interactions only. So everything that I have shown you thus far, or most of what I have shown you that thus far, pertains to the normal virtual brains or the virtual brains that are reconstructed from a normal spectrum. But if you, and now I'm going to show you traces of virtual brains from the background group where no brain rhythms are present. And what you see obviously is that the activity is very random, and basically all nodes display the same kind of random activity. In the incomplete group, which are virtual brains lacking high frequency bands, you only see some form of low frequency spindles. And you see that only in the most important nodes, whereas the weakly connected nodes basically have like a flat activity. And now, if we go to the virtual brains that have phase locking, that have some sort of entrainment between the different bands, what you would see is some sort of epileptic seizures. Some form of spiky activity shows up here transiently. I don't know how well you can see that, but we see some spikes in some traces. And what we see is that in the hubs of that network, the activity is actually very pronounced. You have like high frequency activity, And as you go down to notes that are less important or more weakly connected, those again have like flat activity. Now, another feature that we observe in all those brains is that, okay, so each dot here corresponds to a virtual brain, and we simulated or we reconstructed 20 virtual brains for each group. So the group that doesn't have any peaks in the spectrum, so the background group, is this one. That would be the normal group. That would be the incomplete group where we are missing the high frequencies, and this is the entrained group that is describing like these epileptic brains. So with the exception, we see some sort of positive or negative correlation between the amplitude of the oscillations, the mean amplitude of the oscillations, and the total excitatory input that they receive, or the total inhibitory input that they receive. And we see a very similar pattern because these networks in general are fairly well balanced in the sense that the more excitation a given node receives, the more excitation it tends to provide. And also the more inhibition it gets, the more inhibition it tends to provide. But also the more excitation that they tend to receive, the more inhibition they receive as well. And that's what gives you overall a linearly stable model. But what my point here is that in general, if you see a correlation, a negative correlation between the amount of excitation converging into a node and the amplitude of the oscillations that you record from that node. In other words, you can identify important hubs or important or strongly connected nodes not just by the complexity of the patterns that they display, but also through the amplitude. And in this case, the smaller the amplitude, the stronger they tend to be connected. Importantly, in brains lacking high frequency activity, that correlation is missing. So from the amplitude of the activity of the nodes, you cannot infer anything about the amount of excitation that they are receiving. I mentioned that before. All groups are structurally balanced. Here I added another group, which is the random group, in which we shuffled randomly the peaks of the power spectrum and reconstructed virtual brains from that. And that group obviously is not physiological, but we just added it as a control. Okay, so this answers the question that I asked at the beginning of the talk. What do brain rhythms tell us about functional brain connectivity? And the answer is brain rhythms are brain rhythms reveal or reflect a very hierarchical network. So we can see it here where we plot the total strength of the node, so basically how much input and output they provide, as a function of the rank. So these are the highly connected nodes, these are the strongly connected nodes, how many of them do you have, and these are the weakly connected nodes. We have in total 8.
Is that what you mean by hierarchical?
What I mean by hierarchical is that most of the strength is concentrated in just a few nodes. Exactly. And you can see it here because you have like a very steep decline in nodal strength, in the strength of the nodes, as you move from one node to the next one that is more weakly connected. So basically, a steep slope here is indicative of a hierarchical network. If you don't have peaks in the spectrum, if you have just a background spectrum, those virtual brains don't have a hierarchical structure because all tend to have the same strength. Whereas in the normal brain, in the incomplete brain lacking high frequencies, and also in the epileptic brains, you have like a very steep decline. Importantly, when you lack high frequencies, that hierarchical structure is much less pronounced. This might suggest that brains from autistic people and also people with schizophrenia, where the high frequencies are strongly dampened, the hierarchical structure, the functional connectivity is not as hierarchical as what you would expect from a normal brain. In the entrained case where you have these epileptic seizures that I showed you, there is some trend for even more hierarchical structure than the normal brain, and that's, that can be explained intuitively. If you have a seizing brain, what you would expect is that at least there are a few hubs that are more strongly connected and more strongly driving the rest of the brain as compared to control, and that's exactly what we see here. Now, we also investigated some network motifs that, in these different groups, and because you have like a combinatorial explosion, we focused on the nodes that are more strongly connected. Okay, so what I'm plotting here on the y-axis is the probability of finding the motif that I plot at the top, and we do it for all the cases that we have investigated: the background, the normal, the incomplete spectrum, the entrained spectrum, and the random case where the peaks are shuffled. Now, peaks reflect complex eigenvalues of the connectivity matrix. If you have a real matrix, in order to have a complex eigenvalue, in order to have a peak, you need at least two nodes, because you need a matrix of order 2 in order to have a complex eigenvalue, because you are going to have obviously the complex conjugate as well. So for just two nodes or even three nodes, the differences of finding a given motif is not going to be very apparent, because most of the features that we are seeing is actually from the interactions between different peaks. So if you want to see interactions between two peaks, you need at least an order 4 matrix or 4 nodes, because that's the minimum that you need to see two peaks. You need at least interactions between 4 nodes to see two peaks. So we are going to investigate motifs of between two nodes where you have one excitatory connection and one inhibitory connection. Regardless of what the strength of those is, remember that we are focusing only on connections between hubs, between strongly connected nodes. So this one and that one have opposite signs, but the strength is actually very high in both of them, and it's not necessarily symmetric in absolute value. Now, when we go to three nodes where we have like recurrent excitation and inhibition, then we start seeing some differences between these guys. But when we start considering more nodes, the probability of finding those motifs is becoming more apparent. For example, here where you have like these cyclic graphs, where you have perfectly balanced excitation and inhibition recurrently, that seems to be a feature that is more frequent in the normal brain, normal virtual brain. And here you see that in the epileptic brain, this motif starts to stand out. Okay, that becomes much more frequent. Yes. Okay, that's an important thing. In the random case, we shuffled the peaks randomly. But one thing that I should tell you is that we are lumping together here the output from all the virtual brains, and for each virtual brain out of the 20 that we reconstructed, each of those in the random case had a different spectrum. So they had like a different realization of the shuffling of the peaks. So it's not very consistent. Whereas in all these other cases, the peaks are pinned in the frequency range. here we have actually like a very inhomogeneous mixture of different spectra, each of which is random in a given virtual brain of that group. So what I guess what I'm trying to say is that we should ignore the gray bar. Okay, that's the bottom line of what I'm trying to say, because this in this case, so basically the thing, the control that we wanted to have is the position of the peaks. Okay, so that's the reason why we introduced this group, but actually that group is extremely random. So I can't interpret those bars in this context. I can provide an explanation for that. Okay, it was more like a control of how important the position of the peak is to generate any kind of activity. And if you keep increasing the number of nodes, then you allow for more interaction between frequency bands that can be captured, and then is when we start seeing really dramatic differences between the groups. Again, please ignore the gray bar. Okay, I shouldn't have shown it here. So this cyclic graph is more prominent in the normal group. This one is much more prominent in the entrained group, mimicking epileptic brains. And here, this one is more common in the incomplete case where you are lacking high frequencies. So there is a lot of heterogeneity here, but there are some rules of thumb that we can extract, and is that the normal group is characterized by cyclic graphs, where you always have balanced excitation and inhibition coming out and coming in, but also some of the radial motifs. These are the radial motifs where you have a guy in the center and the other guys are surrounding you. And in the normal group, one thing that you see very frequently is that at least in one guy you have inhibition coming in and inhibition coming out, which is the kind of structure that you would expect, for example, in a pacemaker. If you have reciprocally inhibited, if you have groups of neurons that are connected reciprocally through inhibition, you tend to generate pacemakers. You don't have pacemakers in this case, but at least in the normal group, you tend to have that kind of connectivity. So again, the general feature, or you know, the recipe that would identify the normal group is that you have cycle graphs that are highly symmetric and highly balanced, but in the radial motifs, you do have some symmetry breaking between excitation and inhibition. And what we propose is that deviations from those structural patterns might be indicative of some pathological or at least abnormal functional connectivity. Okay, so the summary of the talk, of the things that I have shown you, is that from the power spectrum of normal EEG, we can reverse engineer network architectures, which we refer to as virtual brains. And when we simulate the dynamics that those brains can display, then we see features from real brains like spindles and some sharp waves in the case of the entrained group, where we allow for phase locking between the different frequency bands. So also, not only the dynamics is similar, but also within the same group, we see topological features, the motifs, that are also consistent. So from that, we infer that the actual brain must have some of the features that our virtual brains display. And we also see consistent deviations from those topological features, and those might be also present in, abnormal brains. So the future work, there are like two components that we are trying to work on within this framework. One is the investigation of some form of functional connectivity in non-linear models. What we have done here is to linearize around the resting state and Basically, that reduces the problem to a, or that allows us to describe the dynamics as a multivariate Ørsted-Uhlenbeck process. That's very convenient because everything is linear in spite of being stochastic, and the functional connectivity can be represented as a matrix. But, you know, if you consider the full model, not just the resting state, but, you know, if you go to the neural mass model, it would be interesting to investigate how the functional connectivity is in the full model. And this is also related to one of the clinical applications that we are interested in. We recently started a collaboration with people at the Cleveland Clinic about how to estimate functional connectivity in epileptic brains. So they do invasive recordings from epileptic patients. And for the neurosurgeons and the neurologists, one important question is to locate the focus of the epileptic seizure. When they see spiky activity, population spikes, highly nonlinear dynamics, they are happy because they can identify the epileptic seizure right there with the electrodes that they implant in the brain. So that's actually good news for them. Now, the problem is that in many cases, they don't see the epileptic seizure, and they don't see it neither with fMRI nor with the electrodes. But if you see the activity from the electrodes that they have implanted in the brain, it looks very linear, very smooth looking. And now the question is whether from that dynamics, you can see some form of activity that allows you to compare between, that basically allows you to identify the locus, the focus of the epileptic seizure. So we have very preliminary data on that, and I can't show them to you right now. So I would like to finish by thanking my lab, my students, and especially Karl Steinke, who, as I told you before, was you know, the key person in this project, and also my sponsors, the Mount Sinai Healthcare Foundation and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Thank you very much for your attention. Okay, very good. So really what I'm showing you is functional, or let me define again functional. Functional is basically the connectivity matrix of the Ørsted-Uhlenbeck process. Okay? Now let me get a little bit more into that because I think that's an important point. In these virtual brains that we reconstruct, we have no spatial information whatsoever because we don't put it in us either. I mean, we are not putting any information in the model. The only information that we put in is the spectral properties, so basically the power spectrum. So from that, we don't expect to retrieve or to get out any kind of topological information. So when I talk about important nodes, strongly connected nodes, that's really within the model, and it's not intended to model any actual part of the brain, like, for example, that the thalamus would be like one of the driving guys and the rest would be the followers. Now, we can try to interpret what would be the equivalent in an actual brain of those nodes. And if you take take the normal brain as an example, then obviously the thalamus would be like a strongly connected node, but that's not necessarily the activity that you would record from in a real EEG, right? So this is really functional in the sense that we are investigating some kind of coupling between nodes, but it's not necessarily anatomical, okay?